Hello everyone, my name is Crystal Hicks.
And my name is Lucy Malarkey.
And we're from WISH, which is womeninsocialhousing.org, and you're listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast.
This is a podcast where we delve deeper into stories from inspirational women who work in the social housing sector, to understand the barriers that they've overcome, to be inspired by their journeys, and to learn from their experiences. And we'll of course be asking the big question, if they had one wish, what would it be and why?
Hello everyone and welcome to the If I Had One Wish podcast. I'm Crystal Hicks and I'm joined by my co-host today,
Lucy Malarkey.
We are delighted in this episode to be chatting to Angela Lockwood. Angela has been an inspirational female leader in the sector for many years. Until July this year, she was chief executive of North Star, a housing association operating in some of the most deprived communities across Teesside and southwest Durham. So North Star is a fairly small housing association with a stock of around 4,000 properties, but Angela's leadership has achieved great things, as we'll go on to discuss today. And it's really known for its innovative approach to people development, both staff and with the board. So throughout her career, Angela has held a variety of non-exec director leadership roles, including being a board member of the National Housing Federation and PlaceShapers, and a non-exec director at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and Mears PLC. And like Lucy, she's a rather happy Sunderland football fan. So thank you for joining us today, Angela. You've had a really interesting career. So I'm really intrigued to know more about your career story and what brought you into the social housing sector and really importantly, why you've stayed.
Well, like most people who enter social housing, they kind of fall into it, don't they? It was never kind of my ambition when I was at school that I was going to work in social housing, even though I lived in social housing and I knew all about it because I was raised in social housing and knew the value of it. So, you know, I just needed a job, Crystal. So I saw this job being advertised at Sunderland Council for a housing management assistant. This is a really funny story, actually. I was so young and stupid at the time. And I thought, oh, housing management assistant. I like the word housing, I like the word management, and I like the word assistant. Those combined sound very interesting. So I went along for the interview. It was a 9-month temporary job and I was interviewed by somebody from Sunderland Council who said to me, you know, you'd be the first person who's done this job since the war. And I was thinking, well, how very strange. The first female person who had done this since the war. And I thought, well, that's very odd. Anyway, no, never mind. Quite liked the money. Gave me the job. Turned up at Rye Brent office in Sunderland. And they said, oh, who are you? I said, oh, I'm the new housing management assistant. And they said, oh, you're the rent collector. I went, no, I'm the housing management assistant. Then I knew why I was the only female, first female since the one. I thought, oh, well, you know, hey, I'll give it a go, you know. The men must have been about three times my age, you know, the dyed-in-the-wool rent collector. So there was me, you know, a bright lass coming in, and I thought, who the hell's this? So I started doing rent collecting. And actually, what I learned was, I mean, you know, rent collecting is rent collecting, but what I learned was how really enjoyable it was to interact with people on the doorstep. Mainly women, actually, because it was mainly women who paid the rent or came and explained why they couldn't pay the rent. Mm. And I really liked that social interaction. And I thought, oh, you know, this is not bad, this. I mean, it was bottom-rung job in housing because nobody really wanted to be a rent collector. My ambition was to move out of that job. And then I got a job similar after 9 months at Home Group. And that was a tougher job, actually. And there started my career in housing. So, you know, I've done it from the bottom really all the way through, which is incredibly useful because I just know how it works. Nobody can tell me how it works because I know. And I stuck at it because you know, I get social housing and I get the difference social housing makes to people. And I love the interaction with people who just need, you know, something often a little bit more than Just a little bit of a leg up, really, and I've loved being able to support people in the community. So that's how it all started. So, no, I was a bit young and daft at the time.
Were you handed one of those brown satchels in the traditional rent collecting ways when you started?
I was in green, blue and yellow Kalamazoo strips, which I didn't have a clue what to do with. Yeah. And what's really interesting, Lucy, the men who were trying to look out for me had rearranged the rent collection patches, so I had the worst one. I had the most difficult one.
Very kind.
At Gilly Law, which was the maisonettes at the time that nobody wanted because you couldn't get a penny's worth of rent and it was a bit iffy. Yeah, it was great learning.
Amazing.
That's brilliant. You know, one of the words you said quite a lot of times there when answering that was people. And people has been your focus throughout your career, hasn't it? Whether we're talking about tenants, customers, or, you know, people with whom you've worked or people who've worked for you. I mean, as we said at the start, you know, under your leadership, North Star has achieved phenomenal people and cultural results over the years. You were the first in the sector to get IIP Investors in People Platinum status. 3 stars from the Sunday Times Best Companies to Work For. You were described as extraordinary in a positive rather than negative way, because I think sometimes that word can be used in both senses. And you were voted number one housing provider by your peers. So tell us, how did you achieve that? What has been the focus? What did you do to really put people at the heart of the business?
Well, you know, I think it goes back before my career, because I was raised in a mining community. My dad was a miner. And the thing I learned about mining communities was that they're very community oriented, they're very trusting. And there's a bit of research actually that's been done about why mining communities are so trusting. And it was it's because when the men are in the pit, or were down the pit, they were relying on each other for their own lives. So they had to trust the people who were in the mines with them. And I think that kind of spilled out into the community. So I was very aware how trust operated and how important people were. And also, really importantly, how women held things together in the community. I just watched it, you know, I watched it through the strikes, how the, you know, the men were striking, but it was the women who held it together, who went out to work, who sorted out the kitchens, who, you know, the women. Ironically, through the Thatcher period, Thatcher did not a lot for the mining communities, but they did a lot for the women in mining communities, because they then were thrust forward into a more dominant position in the mining communities. That's never left them because they were very capable and able. So I watched all of that happening. You know, I was raised with it. It was kind of imbued in me. So I thought, you know, I could see the magic of people in these communities. So, you know, that kind of is just part of who I am. So I think, and I thought then, and I still think to this day, that it's people who make the difference in organisations. You know, systems, processes and IT are important enablers, but actually, if you haven't got the right culture and the right people, will fall down. So that was my starting point. And then I kind of reinforced it by the rent collection, you know, getting to know people on the doorstep and working things out with them. And then moving into different roles in home group, actually. I was at the time, spent 11 years there. And being able to kind of experiment a bit, that kind of just constantly reinforced that it was the people who were making the difference and not everything else around it. So some people will argue, and somebody pointed this out to me as I was leaving. They said, I think you've created your own mining community within North Star. I thought, oh, well, I hadn't thought of it that way, but, you know, I'll take that because I'm a very proud miner's daughter, so I'll have that every day of the week.
Brilliant.
And what happened for me at North Star, just to keep going, really, when I was learning my trade, you know, so I worked my way through the ranks at Home Group, and I got qualified, you know, and I did really well. Home Group was a great organisation for me. It was the biggest housing association at the time, and it led me to do all sorts of brilliant things. I learned lots about how to do things, but I learned lots about how I wouldn't do things when I was in a position of influence. you know, because I used to think, oh, I don't think that's right. You know, I've got to do it because I'm being told to do it, but I'm not sure that I would do that. So I gathered the learning as I was going through. And then when I was in a position of influence, I was able to take all of my learning and all of the things that I wouldn't do and kind of roll them up into one. So whenever I've been in a position of influence, I've been able to bring all of my learning around people with me. And that's been brilliant, and it's always succeeded and worked for me. And of course, when I was chief executive of North Star, that meant it was the whole organisation. It was a bigger task and a bigger challenge, but fundamentally, the principles were the same for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's been about people and it's been about trust, hasn't it, as well? That's been a really key component of your leadership at North Star. And is that trusting people to deliver what they need to do, trusting people to deliver it in the best way? How's that work?
Yeah, it's all of those things, Lucy. It's and I don't know how comfortable, you know, generally leaders are with being trusting. I mean, I think people understand the words, but it's the behaviours behind the words that really matter, because, you know, who wouldn't say trust's a good thing? But you've got to learn how to do it. You know, otherwise, it's just words. It's just futile, really. People don't take you seriously. So I was absolutely determined when I was a new chief executive that I was going to kind of experiment with very high levels of trust, which was very scary because, you know, as a first time chief exec, you've got a lot to prove and, you know, you've got a lot on the line. But I did think that this was my moment to put into practice what I thought was the right thing to do. So I had to first work out, this is the hard bit, for me, it was the hardest bit. I was working with some great people and they were testing me on how trusting I was really up for, how much trust was I really up for, you know. Because it's one thing saying it and then when you step into it and people are trusted to get on and you think, oh, I don't like that, I didn't really mean that. You know, the whole thing falls apart.
I wouldn't have done it that way, yeah.
Oh, I don't think that's right, you know. So I had to kind of test myself as, firstly, was I really up for letting go and working with people? And then the whole senior team had to do the same, and then it cascades through the organisation. And it is, it's policy light, you know. So I've been committed to having policies that keep us safe and legal and give some guidance, but not policies that try and tell everybody what to do in every single situation, because that's impossible. So kind of guiding principles that we've worked out together. So if you walked into North Star, you wouldn't find a bundle of big policies that people refer to on the hour, by the hour. You'd find some guiding principles that they work with. And if the guiding principles don't work, then they revisit them. And that provides people with enough framework to understand what their job is and enough flexibility to do the right thing. Because doing the right thing is really important and requires trust. Because people are different, aren't they? Every day in housing, you encounter different issues and problems that there's no policy in the world is going to tell you what to do with. And so what you do is you trust the person to do the right thing. I used to say to people, do you know what? I know that you're sensible and I know that you make really good decisions and it's fine if it doesn't go right, but just do the right thing. And I tell you what, it never lets you down. There's a bit of alchemy in all of that. People don't want to let you down and they never do. And if mistakes happen, you just blooming well sort them out.
Yeah.
One of the best sort of catchphrases that has really helped me with developing that sort of culture of trust is that idea of failing forward. Mm. So it's not always about, I'm not trusting you to always get it right.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't mind if you get it wrong. It's if we're learning and we're moving forward in getting it wrong. And I think it just changes people's mindsets. And I think that's sort of, I can hear that in what you're saying, Angela, around saying, you know, I really trust you and your judgment, you're sensible. But it's also, it sounds like it's caveated with, and if it doesn't go the way that we thought we wanted it to go, that's also fine.
Yeah,
and we'll learn from that.
Live it and live those values. That's important, you know, because, you know, people can say it, but then they don't live it. We've got to live it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that psychological safety is the wraparound with trust, isn't it? That people have got to feel that the organisation will support them, that their line manager will support them. And, you know, like Crystal says, we can all make mistakes, but we do it in an environment where we learn from it and we move on as well. You know, that doesn't become a barrier to doing the right thing the next time. making that judgment. Yeah.
You're spot on, Lucy. And I think what people underestimate is how helpful it is for managers when they have staff who feel trusted and are able to just crack on and make their own decisions, because then managers are not getting bogged down either in stuff that they don't need to get bogged down in. And they're everybody's freer in that environment. And the biggest test I had, and I'll share this with you, on trust, and it scared the eebie-jeebies out of me, I'll not lie, was when we had the rent reduction. And, you know, when government decided that we're going to reduce our rents over 4 years, and we had 3 months to revisit the business plan, and everybody was running around trying to find servants. And I thought, well, I can do this in a conventional way that most organisations are doing, which is the senior team and some of the managers will get in a room, they'll get a red pen, and they'll start looking at the budgets and just putting red lines through budgets. And then, you know, we'll make the servants and life goes on. And I could have done that. And that was an option. But I decided not to do that. I decided this was a real challenge of trust. And so what we did was we went to every single function in every single team, and we explained how much savings we had to make. And we had 3 months, we explained we had 3 months to do it, that we really believed that they would know how to make better savings than the senior team, because they knew the business better than the rest of us. They would know where the fat was better than the rest of us. They would know what we could do without better than the rest of us. And we trusted them to make really good decisions. And we gave them a month to come back with an offer in terms of savings. And in that month, I was sweating, because I thought, if we don't get the savings that we need, I haven't got a viable business plan. But I had to test myself on this. And as did the senior team. And do you know what? We got more savings from the people than we needed. They all made absolute sense. And what happened was they owned the savings. So there was no kickback against, you know, why have you cut this? Why have you cut that? Why have you done this? You know, they didn't feel done too, because they had made the decisions themselves. And the only thing I said to them was, I wasn't looking to make anybody redundant, so not to go near the staff. Perhaps we would hold vacancies, but I wasn't looking to make anyone redundant. And that gives them a sense of my loyalty towards people in the organisation and the value I placed on them. So when you enter into that kind of contract, people rise to the challenge. And honestly, we flew through that process. Everything was delivered and we made more servants than we needed. But by God, I was sweating on it.
I bet you were.
Like, you were very brave, Angela, and it paid off. You're really working at sort of the outer margins of your comfort zone there, but it seemed to really have paid off for you. I'm going to sort of just change track a little bit, if you don't mind, and dig into your experience as a female leader. And you are a very experienced leader, Angela, and you will have seen throughout your career challenges across the sector. You've alluded to some there on the rents, but what do you think have been sort of the biggest challenges maybe you faced and had to overcome? And have you got any sort of lessons that you could share with us from those?
Yeah, so I do think the biggest challenge that I've had is overcoming the fact that I'm a woman in a primarily man's world. So when I was on a senior team at Home Group, I was the only woman. When I came to Endeavour, I was the only woman. You know, so it's an interesting experience being an only woman. And I had the benefit of doing a MBA up at Newcastle Business School. And I did a dissertation on gender in housing. And I had a fantastic professor, woman, who I worked alongside, and kind of she helped me make sense of what was going on for me in my career, and why I was feeling the way I was feeling. Because I often felt, didn't matter how senior I was until I was the chief exec, I often felt that I had to work harder than anyone else around the table to be seen. I was quite invisible. So my way of getting visibility was to work harder and to prove myself. So I always felt I worked harder. I always felt that I was the first to be dismissed when I had a view or an opinion. I always felt that I was the butt of the jokes. It was quite subtle, but it goes in. I used to see that the men would make suggestions that I had made weeks ago that were not heard. And so I used to think to myself, well, Angela, it must be you. There's something wrong with you. So what you need to do is you just need to try harder. You need to watch how they're doing things, and you need to adapt and adjust your behaviour accordingly, because it's you, it's not them. And it didn't matter how I adjusted or adapted, I was always still on the outside looking in. And this was happening to me frequently. So it was becoming a pattern. And when things become a pattern, you know there's something going on. You know, it's not a one-off. And it was definitely affecting me. And my function was performing incredibly well. But there was no recognition of how it was happening. And then when I did the dissertation and I did a lot of research, I saw the light, really, because I could tell. I instantly knew what was happening to me. There was very subtle discrimination going on because I was the only woman in the room. Now, there's a piece of research that says, and I love this research and I used it in my dissertation, that when there's a room full of people, if you're in a minority of two or three in a big room, it could be disability, it could be colour, ethnicity, it could be gender. The whole group works against the minority in a very subtle way, a very subtle way. So you're often excluded when you're a minority in a group. This is just what happens. And if you asked anybody who's, I was just having a chat with a person who, an Afro-Caribbean woman the other week, and she feels exactly the same way. Or if you spoke to some, it could be a man in a room full of women. It just happens, but it's blooming hard. And it's like a microaggression, do you know what I mean? And then when I was doing my dissertation and I interviewed six or seven chief exec women, they had all felt the same. They had all felt the same way. For many of them, they hadn't realised what was going on, but they felt uncomfortable in their group when it was all men. And as I was chatting to them, they kind of were realising that what was going on was some kind of exclusion, you know. And it's hard. It's a tough way. But once you know it's happening and you know it's not you, you think, right, okay, well, hey, do you know, I'm so happy I've recognised it. I'm not stupid, and I can do my job. And it doesn't matter how hard I try, I'm never going to get full acceptance. So Angela, just take your foot off the gas. I wish I'd learned that earlier in my career, because it took me donkey's years to get to that point. And I'd love women to just listen to this and think, God, that's happening to me. And if it is happening to them, don't always assume it's you, I think is the best advice I could give to women. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. And I think that is such brilliant advice. You know, we've all been in that position at different times, different occasions, haven't we, in our lives, of being that absolute minority, that one or two, you know, like you say, based on, you know, difference, whatever that aspect of difference may be. And it is incredibly uncomfortable. And I think exactly what you say about then feeling the need to change the way we behave or to do more, be busier, you know, be better, that does become all consuming. And so I think that advice about recognizing that, you know, you don't have to change, you shouldn't change, and you don't have to have your foot down on the gas, as you say there, you know, going full throttle. You are brilliant as you. And I suppose, so yeah, I was going to ask you about advice you would give your younger self, but perhaps that's probably it, is it?
It is. Yeah. And I think what the research did to me was it made me understand more about what was happening for me. And And what I found really interesting was the research tells us this, and I discovered this through my own dissertation, that what happens with women is, you know, they try and become more male because that's how to become accepted. So they use the language of the men, and they'll go to the pub with the men, and God forbid, some of them even play golf, which I never, ever, ever could ever do. I have to say, I drew the line of golf. You know, but they're trying to become accepted, the kind of try and learn male traits. And then the description of women when they have developed these male traits is very different from the description of men.
Yeah.
You know, so women can be called shrill or difficult or bossy. Now, you don't use those descriptors for men. You would say they're ambitious and driven, you know, And I watched that going on. And those descriptors for women are undermining as well. But that's what happens. Mm-hmm. And women often have had to do that to become accepted. And one woman I was talking to said that she started to actually dress like a man because she felt that she just got the end of the road and didn't know what else to do. Now, you know, that's the extreme ends of it. But you can see how harder it is for a woman to be a leader versus a man, you know. And I think there's something in that about women understanding that that's happening and therefore being able to make different decisions rather than just keep them going.
Definitely.
Anjali, you've really dedicated your career to the social housing sector. And, you know, you look at all of the things that you've achieved, you've really grasped some opportunities that have come your way to influence and make a positive difference. We do always like to sort of dig in a little bit to anything that you may have let slip by, you know, any opportunities that you couldn't take up because of whatever reason at the time that maybe you've regretted looking back. Is there anything you would have loved to have done that that you weren't able to?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I don't live with too many regrets. I don't dwell on them, you know, too much. If I had another 10-year, the thing I would really like to do is influence diversity more so. I would have liked to have done even more than I had done in my own organisation. I mean, what I didn't say is when I did the dissertation, it was all about the Queen Bee syndrome. So it was when women reach the top, what do they do when they're at the top to help others? And what you find is that when women reach the top, they're exhausted because it's been a bloody hard journey to get to the top and to be accepted. And therefore, they're completely depleted. And then to step out and do something that's very courageous around diversity doesn't feel like they've got the energy to do it. It's just a step too far because they just want to work conventionally. That's what happens in a Queen Bee syndrome kind of theory. In my organisation, a few years ago, we did that. I led on the diversity programme for board members, kind of an apprenticeship, board apprenticeship programme. Because I thought, come on, Anjali, get a grip of this. You are doing everything you can to try and get a board that looks different, because it's important that it starts at the top. And you've done everything you can. You've got phenomenal links with the ethnic minority community across Teesside, the best links. I mean, North Starry houses more ethnic minorities than anybody else in the region. You know, we've got some areas that 90% of our stock's full of Asians and Somalis. You know, our links to to all of the religious groups are as strong as they can be because of our roots. 50 years we've been operating in Middlesbrough. So, you know, if we can't attract people onto the board from an ethnic minority background and other backgrounds through the usual routes, then you have to do something a bit different. And so I give myself a good shake. And board were very, very determined to be different. And so I led on the board apprenticeship programme for the North East. So there were four housing associations involved. And we took four apprentices. I was only going to take two, but I couldn't turn down the other two. So we took more than anybody for our size. And we focused on younger people and ethnicity. And we picked four, and that just happened to be women, but we weren't particularly looking for women because our board's pretty good, you know, in that gender balance, but they happened to be women. And what they did was we wrapped around a great apprenticeship programme. They worked, but we wrapped around it, you know, a two-year apprenticeship programme to get them oven ready to be on a board. And they were, and honestly, those four women were inspirational. I mean, they stayed the whole tier, mainly because we piled resource and support into it and we were so totally committed to it, dedicated. It's a typical North Star. We wouldn't enter into it unless we were completely dedicated to it. And we did get one of them to join the board. One of them joined another board and the other two are joining boards as well. Now, so we've put four people out and into the world who are ready to join boards. Now, I would love to have done much more of that. If I had another 10-year, you know, I'd start really making inroads into experimenting with how we can do things differently to get a better balance of difference in the organisation and at staff level. I mean, you know, we ran a ethnic minority apprenticeship programme a few years ago. That was fantastic. We only went for ethnic minorities because they were underrepresented. I mean, and we employed them all in the organisation. I mean, stunningly good. stunning. I mean, the bright, brilliant people that we got through the organisation. So the organisation has changed, but I think there was more to go. And if I'd had my time over again, I'd have started 10 years ago and done something different then. You can see my passion for diversity. Yeah.
Just a bit.
Just a bit. And the legacy of that passion, I'm sure, will live on. So even though you might not have the 10 years that you would have liked to have done more, I'm sure the legacy of the impact of what you've done will be carried on. That baton will be carried on by others.
And that, you know, was a perfect segue into what I wanted to ask. So, you know, it's not so long ago you retired, Angela, but, you know, we've heard in this conversation we've had these huge amounts of passion and determination that you've still got. So even though you're retired and you're talking there about, you know, if I had the 10 years, I can't imagine you're going to be resting on your laurels anytime soon. So how are, Angela? What else is there that you're going to be up to?
It's a good question, Lucy. And I'd worked full time for 46 years without a break. So I did need a break because I'd worked since I was 16. So I didn't go into further education. I tell you what, I'm an amazing person to have on a board because from a socioeconomic background, I really helped the statistics because, you know, I was from a single parent, I had free school meals. I went to a state school. I left at 16. You know, honestly, there should be queuing up for me. Honestly, form the queue orderly outside the door.
I bet they are.
So I was already on the board of a PLC, which I've continued with because me as PLC run the asylum seeker contracts, Ministry of Justice contracts for ex-offenders. Mm. So there's a kind of bit of that really connects with my social values. I'm a qualified executive coach and mentor. And I said I would only take two people. I'm now up to four, and they happen to be women. I have to stop at four, honestly, or else I'll be back doing full-time work. But I love working. In fact, I've got a session this afternoon with a wonderful woman. I love working with women now, just to be able to share my experience, you know, and talk about gender issues as well, you know, with them and for them. Mm-hmm. Helps enormously. I have been approached to do other stuff, and I've got a few irons in the fire, but the brilliance of where I am now is I can do it through choice. You know, I can choose what I want to do. So I'm being very particular, Lucy, and it has to connect with kind of a core value. And I have to be able to offer something that will bring about a bit of influence. So I'm just mulling over what the opportunities are at the moment. But hey, I'm enjoying. I've been out with a dog on the beach this morning. You know, what's not to like about it? It's freezing cold, but it's lovely out there. Really, it is.
Yes, give yourself the gift of some time, Angela. You've certainly earned it. Mm-hmm. So our podcast is called If I Had One Wish. So the question that we have to ask all of our guests is, if you had one wish for the sector, what would it be and why?
To value women more and value diversity more. I just think that, you know, it's in the majority interest not to change things, because it works for them. It works for them. And I would like to see some disruptors go in there and really shake it up. And I would like everyone, I mean, a core value of mine, it's been tested, is one of fairness. You know, I'm really committed to fairness. And I would like to see everyone have the same opportunities within the housing sector, and I don't think they do currently. So my wish is for diversity to be properly embraced and to see more people coming through who might not ordinarily come through.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much, Angela. It's been fantastic to have you on our podcast.
It's been so lovely, yes. Thank you, Angela.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to meet you two great women who are doing amazing things.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast. Next time, we'll be talking to another inspirational female from the housing sector who will be sharing her career story and what she's learned along the way. And of course, we'll be asking again the big question. If she had one wish, what would it be and why? See you next time.